we could never say, like, what Me Too is saying about anything. Like, what was it? Like, it was a hashtag. It was like a cultural moment. It's just all like people doing takes.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to The Argument. My name is Jerusalem Demsis.
I'm Matthew Iglesias.
And today, my hot take is Me Too did not go far enough.
Okay. I don't want to be like the straw man here. You know, I think like most people feel that some things kind of went too far in certain respects. And I guess I agree with that. And I also think that's kind of banal. That's like a sort of a weak, you know, claim to make about a diffuse kind of movement. I've been dying to have this conversation with somebody for several years now, though, because Me Too was such a signature moment in like culture and society, and especially in the media, like in the industry that we work, which was really kind of the epicenter of Me Too. And the question is like, what happened at all? You know, like, I guess I'm like, I'm open to the interpretation that it didn't go nearly far enough or that it went like way too far because I don't know what, what was it? Like, it was a hashtag. It was like a cultural moment. It was a touchstone. It was a watershed. I'm one of the only people who went and actually saw the movie that they made about the Harvey Weinstein investigation. I thought it was really good. But like when that movie came out, it made me, I was like, I wish this was more popular because I need some think pieces about this. Like what, like Harvey Weinstein went to prison.
Okay, well, so like, let's start here. Like, what was it? So Me Too is a hashtag that's invented like more than a decade before Me Too as a movement really takes off. So in 2006, Tarana Burke, who's like a feminist activist, uses the Me Too hashtag. She explicitly like talks about this as a therapeutic device. Like, it's not even really meant to be a specific policy demand, right? The whole point was to create visibility about the fact that many, many women have experienced sexual assault, sexual harassment, intimidation. And she calls it quote, empowerment through empathy. And like, it's clear that her goal in many ways is that she wants people to know that like other people have had this experience. You shouldn't feel alone if you yourself have experienced sexual violence or harassment, and that like, you're like not isolated, because this is a very common feeling to feel like, oh shit, my whole community's against me. Like, no one else is, I've did something wrong. This is like a freak accident or a freak occurrence and I'm the problem. And like, that was the goal. And I mean, I think a big part of like the conversation has to be like, how effective is that at the way that we often measure the output of social movements, which is specific legal changes. And like, we can get into that. There's obviously some stuff that's happened with NDAs, especially, you know, pre-harassment NDAs and things like that. But I think that like, at core, the problem that women are often trying to solve, or feminists are trying to solve with movements like Me Too, is that like, you want cultural change. It's not like, hey, if someone rapes you and then you go to the cops, they will go to prison. Like, you just want there not to be sexual harassment. Like, that's like the main goal. Like, sorry, to be clear, people do want to be able to go to the cops and say that. But I mean, like, the daily sexual harassment that was being talked about, especially in workplaces or whatever, like, most women don't want to report something like that and go through a difficult process that is, even in the best of circumstances, extremely difficult, costly, alienating, and often like it's from a member of their own community. Like, they don't really want to, quote unquote, like ruin someone's life, as you know, anti-feminists are constantly accusing them of doing. And what they want is cultural shift. They want it to not be normalized to talk about women like this in public. They want it to not be normalized to make sexist jokes in the office, or to like harass someone who you want to go out with you, or to be treated like an object. Like, that's like a very difficult, you can't legislate that stuff. You can't like make people with law think about women differently in the workplace. And sure. So like, you know.
Okay. But so I think that was like a rich response.
And thank you, Matthew.
It contains within it some of my, perplexities, or not perplexities. You know, I'm a very literal person, and it's one of the reasons that I think I struggled a little bit with this cultural moment, because it, and I'm like a splitter by nature. You know, I like to take things. I mean, this is college and philosophy class. It's always like, when in doubt, draw a distinction, right? And a lot of Me Too is lumping rather than splitting, right? And it's saying like—
What do you mean?
Well, because there's like a continuum of bad experiences that a person might have in which the core, like hardcore of Me Too is sexual assault in the workplace.
Yeah.
Right? Like that was sort of the main thing that Me Too was about. But then there's a spectrum of like how much is something in the workplace, right? You know, there's like things that are related to work or like people you meet through work or, you know, things like that. And then there's like a spectrum of like sex-related experiences that are unpleasant.
Yeah.
Right? That can exist like itself on a broad continuum. And as you said, like the original Me Too hashtag and sort of the campaign, right, was therapeutic, was about making people feel heard, making them know that their experience was not unique, et cetera, et cetera. So that encouraged like a lumping mentality, right? Like literally, like Me Too, right?
Yeah.
It's never going to be, well, exactly the thing that happened to you happened to me. It's like, well, this thing that's similar kind of happened. And so you're eliding degrees of difference, which is fine. I mean, because I don't want to be like, well, anything that happens to you that's not the worst thing that could possibly happen to someone, who cares, whatever. But when you're thinking about policy remedies, like you do need to think about drawing lines and drawing distinctions, right? And, you know, you also mentioned, you were like, well, people don't want like rapists to go to prison. And then you're like, no, actually, I do want rapists to go to prison.
No, to be clear, I did not say people don't want rapists to go to prison. My point is that like the sexual, even people who get, well, many, many women who experience even like horrific sexual violence, their dream scenario is not to like go through a long, arduous and difficult legal process where they unearth that for the public, for courts, get quiet. Like, even if it ends with a conviction, it's just like bad.
Absolutely. Yes.
The soundbite like, was a little bit rough, man.
No. But I mean, I think this is relevant, though, because Me Too, like in its apogee form, right? Not 2006, but, you know, Weinstein and stuff, came at the same time as like criminal justice reform was really ratcheting up as a progressive cause, right? And this was like one of these moments where like, I really wished we could get like a roundtable meeting of the Progressive High Council and like get the people who, you know, circa 2019, right? Like the people who are increasingly fired up about gun control after Parkland and Las Vegas, and the people who are increasingly fired up about criminal justice reform, and the people who are increasingly fired up about sexual harassment. Like we all need to like sit around the table and decide like, what is it that we're saying here?
Matt, you want the omni-cause again. Another pro-omni-cause take from
this
Matt.
It's not omni-cause. It's that like, I want some like reconciling of differences, right? Because, you know, I mean, I remember, right, like there was a famous June 2020 New York Times op-ed, like, yes, we literally mean abolish police, right? Where Maria Callas says she's going on at some length. And then eventually she's like, what about rape? Because she acknowledges that like punishing sexual assault had like become a progressive cause. And she's like, well, the existence of prison like hasn't ended rapes or sexual assaults, which I guess is true. The criminal justice system infamously, I think, has historically not dealt very well with those kind of complaints. But that critique of the criminal justice system is still like a normie criminal justice take, right? Yeah. Is to come to the table and say, look, traditionally, almost all police officers have been men. The courts and the prosecutorial system has been dominated by men. The common law of rape and sexual assault was like put forward in a very patriarchal society. And we want to revise all that so that these complaints are taken more seriously, not because what individual victims want is to go through this very painful prosecutorial process, but because prosecutions have a useful deterrent effect. And that like, sure, yes, like we want a cultural shift in which people understand that this isn't okay. But like, we understand that like stealing packages off someone's doorstep isn't okay, but also people still do it. And whether or not they think they're going to get caught and punished is a relevant variable in all of this.
Totally. To be clear, I think that like these things are, I mean, I remember wrestling with this a lot when I was, so I was in college during kind of the height of Me Too, and I had like a really difficult time actually reconciling my views around criminal justice reform and like the increasing radicalization I was feeling around this question of like, how do you deal with people who are kind of making, you know, doing casual, what I viewed as like near criminal behavior that was not being treated as criminal behavior of sexual harassment and sexual assault that didn't rise to the level of rape, but was like something that I thought was like quite harmful to women in the workplace, in school, in life, in general, children, whatever. And I think it's like, this is a tension. Like, it's how do you do that? And like, to me, like part of why, I mean, what you're getting at is like part of why there was such a focus on cultural shift here is that a lot of feminists have been skeptical about using the legal system to actually fully resolve these problems. And I think there's like some good evidence for this. So like Catherine MacKinnon was the woman who in 1979 wrote the big book. She was at Yale Law School at the time, or she's getting a PhD, I'm not sure. But she was a feminist legal scholar who was writing about the category of sexual harassment, which is like before then was like not a legal category in 1979. Mm-hmm. Like it's like quite recent. And she writes this op-ed in 2018 in the New York Times called Me Too Has Done What the Law Could Not. And she says, quote, "This mass mobilization against sexual abuse through an unprecedented wave of speaking out in conventional and social media is eroding the two biggest barriers to ending sexual harassment in law and in life, the disbelief and trivializing dehumanization of its victims." And it's just sort of like, no matter what you do to the legal categories, like no matter what you do to make police officers much more amenable, they're not going to say like not saying horrible things to victims, at some level, many, many sexual assault cases are just he said, she said cases. It's like no one else was there. There's no other evidence. And like, obviously, witness testimony is evidence. Like that's like an important piece of evidence. But like both people can have different accounts of what's going on. And like the legal system has like trouble with those cases, especially if there's not physical evidence of adjudicating what to do in that situation, especially because we have strong norms around innocent until proven guilty. High burden of proof is on the prosecution. And that's all well and good. But like, because of all of that, that like really, really does mean that like unlike things like murder or theft or like other crimes that like we could imagine would have, you know, there could be like extremely strong deterrent effects in place as a result of, you know, high clearance rates or whatever it is. It's actually like not clear to me that like you could get the same amount of effect with rape and sexual assault cases that are very, very difficult to find good evidence to support. And so I think that because of that, like, it's just a much harder problem that people often tend not to appreciate. And like Catherine MacKinnon's whole point here is that you can't just solve this through like legal remedies. Like, I think with murder, you like could do that. Like there's a body or there's a missing person and like, everyone knows that this person is dead and you have to solve that crime. It's just like not the case. Like people have difficulty believing these crimes even happen. And also just like from like this question of like from the victim's point of view, like, yes, of course you want your, you know, assaulter to go get held accountable or whatever. But like really when you talk to or you read accounts of people who have experienced sort of thing, like it's like the secondary victimization of like nobody believing you, people treating you like you're a whore, like whatever it is. I don't know if we can say that on this. Did we get like flagged by the authorities or whatever? I curse a lot on this podcast. But people treating you like terribly afterwards or your friends and family, like that's often what is described as like some of the most like traumatizing bits of it in a way that like doesn't happen if like, you know, you get like assaulted on the street and you get like punched in the face and there's like a bruise. Everyone's like, whoa, like I'm really sorry that happened to you. Everyone's like on your side or whatever. So anyway, I just think like people don't appreciate like how much of a more different problem this is than like other types of crimes.
Yeah, let's take a break and then I want to dig into that. The Argument is brought to you by Forkful. Finding time for meal planning and cooking can be a challenge. So many meal kits out there promise convenience, but they require lots and lots of prep and cleanup. A lot of meal services use industrial seed oils that can be harmful to your body. Forkful meals prioritize flavor, function, and health. They've got zero seed oils. It's chef-cooked, fresh, ready-to-eat meals. It's made with high-quality proteins. You've got grass-fed bison. You've got wild-caught salmon. You've got really fresh vegetables. They've got all different kinds of meals that fit your lifestyle and your preferences. If you're gluten-free, they've got you covered. If you're dairy-free, they've got you covered. If you're eating keto, they've got you covered. If you're plant-based, they've got you covered. Or you can just order off their general menu. Eating well does not need to be complicated. With fully prepared, deliciously healthy meals, no meal prep, cooking, or cleanup, just clean flavors, ready in under 3 minutes, delivered directly to your door within 24 to 48 hours. Explore our plans and menu of fresh, ready-to-eat meals at ForkfulMeals.com and use code ARGUMENT to get 50% off your first order. That's ForkfulMeals.com/argument. Use promo code ARGUMENT for 50% off. Thanks to Forkful for sponsoring this episode. So, I feel like McKinnon in that piece is selling herself and her own work a little bit short.
Yeah.
Because it's true that, you know, there's cultural shift, right? And that, like, it's hard for just kind of the fist of the law to alter people's behavior. And also, everything you said about sexual assault is, because it tends to happen in private, you know, is a more challenging kind of crime to prove than a lot of other things. That's factually true. I do think, though, that a lot of the cultural shift that McKinnon is talking about there was, in fact, downstream, specifically of her work. You know, that she publishes, I guess it's a law review article in the late 1970s. This percolates through the legal system in the 1980s, but it really sort of goes mainstream after the Clarence Thomas hearings. That's the first time that, like, a lot of people heard about the fact that, like, there is this concept in civil rights law of the hostile workplace environment, you know, yeah. Which is, like, not physical assault. Right. It's like she's actually putting on the table a distinct idea from the longstanding notion of rape and sexual assault. And people hear about it for the first time, a lot of them in the 1990s. There's a lot of pop culture that is now, like, on that topic. And some of it, in retrospect, like, there was this very big hit movie in the 90s called Disclosure that was like, what if a woman did sexual harassment to a man? And it's like,
who is in this movie? What is this movie?
Michael Douglas. It was huge. And I think today everybody would consider Disclosure probably to be, like, very politically problematic.
I keep getting this 2026 sci-fi movie with with Emily Blunt. Is this talking about something else?
Yes, it is a different one. Okay. Anyway, check it out. But at the time, this was, like, part of mainstreaming the idea that, like, you could have a lawsuit in your company mm-hmm. about sexual harassment. And, like, there are attorneys who specialize in bringing these lawsuits forward. And not everybody was happy about it. But, you know, by the dawn of the 21st century, people, like, knew that this was a thing.
Yeah.
And younger people like me who entered the workplace in the early 21st century, I was not acclimated to an older set of 20th century workplace norms. And you would come in, and I don't want to say that, like, HR trainings, like, alter the universe, because they don't. It's, like, a fairly weak lever. But you show up at your first office job and, like, this is what you get. And you're like, okay, like, this is what the norms
no,
are.
No, I actually, it's so funny. So I feel like I went through my first, like, corporate training, because I didn't work in, like, kind of traditional offices until my third or fourth job out of college. And I remember doing them. And I remember there being, like, both, like, a sexual harassment training and then, like, also, like, a, you know, racial discrimination mm-hmm. training. And, like, sexual harassment training is, like, incredibly clear. It's like, do not, like, do not tell a woman that she looks hot, or, like, don't, like, comment on someone's physical body, whatever. And then the racial training was like, hey, like, whiteness is a form of privilege. And I was just like, no. I just need rules. I want both of these rules to just exist for people. And actually, I mean, I agree with you, to be clear, that, like, I think that culture is not, like, siloed off from policy or law.
Yeah,
these
yeah.
things are, like, interrelated, and that it, you know, a lot of what happened in culture happened downstream of these categories. But, like, I want to dig in on what you pointed out about this, like, kind of process of younger people being, like, completely removed from these older set of norms. Because I think that, like, there's this narrative of backlash right now that I'm not sure is actually as prevalent on the core claim of Me Too as people think it is. So we did a poll at The Argument recently in February looking at gender, and we found that 82% of people say that experiencing harassment and not reporting it is common, including 76% of Trump voters. Like, Me Too's like core empirical claim, right? Which is that like sexual harassment is common and that people are not reporting it, often out of fear of like retaliation or not being believed or whatever. Like, everyone basically believes this is true now. Like, this is just like a background fact. And when you look at like some of the crosstabs to look at like younger, how younger people versus older people are kind of internalizing some of these norms, like 44% of Americans say it's harder for men to socialize with women than they did 10 years ago. Versus 14% saying it's easier. But 18 to 29 is the least likely cohort to say that it's harder. Only 38% of people in that cohort are saying that it's harder. Right. And it's just like,
so people who don't know what they're talking about.
Yes, but I mean, to be clear, like they're able to, they answer these questions all the time in polls, which is like an indication of what their sense of
backlash is.
But yes, they do not remember being in the workplace, except for maybe the 29-year-olds 10 years ago. But I do think there's this like thing here. I mean, throughout the poll too, like we ask about like, do people want to revert to traditional gender norms? People are like hardcore no, like younger people are not like somehow like backlash to this insane level regressive beliefs around gender roles. And I think that there is this like sense, because as you mentioned, kind of like there's obviously in every movement bad things that happen to people in unfair ways, like people who get caught up in this sort of thing and were themselves not actually or should not have been the targets of the movement. But I just think that people have overread from those specific examples, whether it's like the Aziz Ansari case or whatever, to presume that like everyone sort of rejected this, when in reality, like basically everyone has moved to a different baseline. And now it's like, what's next?
Well, but this is sort of what I wonder about, is like, what is next? Because it struck me as a thing where you had a lot of attention and a lot of concern and a lot of social clout and a lot of social power. And what's just not clear to me is like, how was it used?
Yeah.
Right. And like, the fact that a couple people got like swept up in bad articles is not like the problem to me. The problem to me is that, say what Aziz Ansari had been accused of was worse than it really was. And people have been like, okay, this is a good article, right?
Yeah. It was just that like he was kind of, it was a bad sexual encounter, but she didn't accuse him of assault or anything, right? That's what it was.
I would say that like he stood accused of being a playa.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Like, he was like a prominent comedian.
Clip that.
Who was like, I don't know. You know?
She was not even claiming it was like sexual abuse.
Right. But so, you know, the thing about Aziz Ansari is that like he's famous.
Yeah.
So like you could write articles about Aziz Ansari, like all kinds of articles, right? Like you could write an article about his favorite restaurants. Like there's all kinds of things that like might be viable Aziz Ansari content. But as you go down the fame spectrum, you know, this kind of like journalism and shaming is not a really like scalable, kind of workable resource. And something that like I had a lot of personal frustration with was the handling of Leon Wieseltier, who, like, I'll be frank, like, I don't like Leon Wieseltier. He was the literary editor of the New Republic for many years, which sounds like, and is in fact, like a fairly obscure job. Mm-hmm. But in the world of small circulation ideological magazines, it was a very important role. And those magazines themselves used to play an important role as entry rungs for different kinds of journalism. I come out of that world, though not out of the New Republic. I know a lot of people who work there at different points in time.
But he was accused of like kissing women unwanted, like in the workplace, describing like pretty graphically like sexual encounters he'd had with people. He like admitted to it, right? Yeah.
Well, I mean, this is like part of the difficulty of it is, you know, if you read, we published in Vox Sarah Weilman's article about this. I was not like directly involved in that story coming out, but like I was very proud of it. You know, if you read it, right, nobody is going to reach the conclusion like this guy needs to be behind bars 20 to life. You know what I mean? Like, it's not that bad. But what she's saying in the piece is like literally the headline is I spoke up and nothing happened.
Yeah.
Like, which is true. And then when the piece came out, there was this kind of reckoning inside the media industry, including a Michelle Cottle piece titled Leon Wieseltier, a reckoning. And there's like all these prominent journalists who were mid-career people at TNR at the time when Sarah and I were like young journalists. And they were like, oh, you know, like mea culpa, like I didn't really do the right thing. Mm-hmm. But I felt at the time that like they were sort of misportraying what the situation was and like what their level of knowledge and awareness kind of was. And that like my impression is that people knew exactly what he was doing. They also knew exactly that it was wrong. And they just kind of didn't care. Because unlike me, they liked him.
Yeah.
And like thought his work was good. And like now he's once again the editor of a small circulation magazine that seems important in the world of ideas. And I both feel kind of pissed about that. Like that was not an adequate resolution to this, but also I would struggle to articulate, like, what do I think should occur here? Because I mean, you know, if somebody shoots somebody in the leg and they go to prison for assault with a deadly weapon, and then they get out of prison. Like, I want that person to get a job when they're out of prison, right? Like, somebody becomes unemployable for life is, like, not the desired outcome of, like, any kind of wrongdoing. Like, there should be punishment, but, like, people need to exist in society, and, like, having jobs is sort of, like, what you want. But there's something about this kind of having a role of influence in the world of ideas that like rubs me the wrong way versus, well, I found out, you know, Leon Wieseltier is the manager of an IHOP somewhere. But then also it's like, well, okay, but are journalists or like women who I know personally, like are a special protected class, and the people who work at IHOP like should be subjected to harassment? Like that's not my view either.
Yeah.
So now I'm like, what is my view? Like, I'm just mad about Leon Wieseltier because I know the people involved personally or because I work in this industry. But actually, I have no idea, like, what should happen to anybody and no, like, no solutions to offer. And also, but it's also like, it's not even a question of, well, Me Too didn't go far enough, because it's like, there was no ask. There's no, and now here's how we're going to take it as far as it ought to go. We're just kind of like, for a while, we were all publishing those stories. And today, if you pitched that, like, I don't know, like, would the article even run? Or are we just kind of over Me Too at this point?
So there's an element of this, which is just people want others to be held socially accountable. It's not just that, like, you're not saying that you want to, like, thrown out of society. What you're confused at is, why is this person being treated like a person of who should be listened to on these questions of, I mean, I don't read Liberties, the magazine that he does now. I'm not really sure what they publish or whatever, so I can't really speak to that. But I think there's a level here where it's like, it's not that you want him to be sexually harassing people at an IHOP. It's that, like, there's a privilege to having a microphone as an editor or a writer of prominent magazines, working as a politician. I mean, I think this is really relevant to, like, the Graham Plattner conversation that's been happening recently, too. Like, it's not about, like, this person needs to go to jail. It's just, like, should you be in these very vaulted halls of power? And should you have an excess of control over not just, you know, hey, I'm a worker, a manager, and I'm, you know, I'm reformed and I'm doing these things that are, you know, positive for, you know, my company's goals or for my organization's goals or whatever. But it's like, you have control over how people think about policy, about politics, about the role of women in society. And like, I think that, like, there's a one question, which is, has Leon Wieseltier reformed? Is he like a different person now who won't behave in those ways anymore? And that has to be evaluated by, like, prospective employers and his friends and, like, whatever it is, right? And, like, I can't evaluate that. And then, like, there's a second one, which is like, okay, do you have the level of character to have this kind of power in society? And like, again, like there's no law that we're going to do. Like, we're not going to be like, you're banned from starting a magazine if you've ever been accused of sexual harassment. Like, that's like not actually actionable. But I think that like the discomfort you're feeling is like actually part of the shift in culture. Like, what's supposed to happen is that we're like, we're having this conversation, we're like, this feels like wrong to us that like this person gets this access and power, and also like we don't want to send him to jail. And like, I think that like there's a real discomfort people have, which is natural, with like this middle space. But I do think it's actually like a really important space to allow to exist, because not every bad thing someone does means that they should go to jail. And that doesn't mean just because it's not criminal that it's not shameable. And I think that this like area of like public shaming or whatever has been like in some ways overutilized in terms against people who like didn't deserve it. But shame itself is like an incredibly important social tool for keeping people in line. Like, a big part of the reason people like don't take, you know, don't shoplift or whatever, right, is you know, they don't want to get caught or whatever it is. But it's actually like, I guess from the statistics, like quite easy to get away with shoplifting at this point. But mm-hmm. it's also like, it's like embarrassing. Like, you're gonna have a video of you, like, you know, gonna get caught, and people are gonna be like, you stole that from someone. Like, that is like often what is keeping people in check. And I think that like the fact that you can't criminalize much of the behavior that is really harmful to women in the workplace, because, or, you know, even if you do criminalize it, you're just not going to catch people through the criminal justice system. It's like evidence that we need to like be really, really judicious and clear about how we're using that tool, and like invest in that rather than treat it as something that is, you know, always, always wrong.
Yeah, I mean, I agree, but... I mean, I guess to me, right, this is, again, where it would have been helpful. And I understand this was the whole way through 2020, like the social media era led to this incredible surge of leaderless activism, you know?
Yeah.
And like Zeynep Tufekci has a book about this, really, about the sort of... even more dramatic, you know, like Arab Spring, like social media protest movements and things like that. And but we had Occupy Wall Street, we had Me Too, we had Black Lives. I mean, there was a kind of skeleton organization called Black Lives Matter, but like that's not what Black Lives Matter was.
And I mean, specifically in the case of Me Too, like Time's Up, which was the like institution that was meant to sort of take on the mantle of this social movement and move it forward, is like completely discredited because members of its leadership work to support Cuomo, not just like randomly, indirectly, but like quite literally on his sexual assault allegations. And like, to me, like, yeah, like the, like, I think if the NAACP had been caught secretly helping white supremacists,
just to say, like, this is not a critique per se of Me Too, but a critique of that whole era of progressive activism, is that a great thing about Catherine McKinnon being like the leading scholarly force on sexual harassment law is that you can like ask her to write another article. Right. Or if there's something that's like not clear about her view, someone in an interview can try to press her on it and like get an answer.
Yeah.
You know, and you can agree or disagree with the answer. But then we can all say, at least like, this is what Catherine McKinnon is saying about sexual harassment. Whereas we could never say like what Me Too is saying about anything. Right. Like where lines are drawn between different kinds of things, what should and shouldn't be criminal conduct, what kinds of punishments are and aren't important, what kinds of social roles do we think have some kind of special significance. It's just all like people doing takes. Right. And there's a mix of like disputed factual claims and disputed normative claims that would, you know, kind of all like trundle around Twitter and, you know, come out an exhaust port somewhere, and we never knew what was happening. You know, you mentioned this, that you did this survey that was interesting, where you did ask, compared to 10 years ago, do you believe it is easier or harder for men to socialize with women appropriately? I'm not 100% sure I know what I would say to that, because it's a somewhat ambiguous question. Mm-hmm. But I guess, like, one read of it is that, okay, it used to be we could all go out for happy hour after work. People of different, genders and different occupational roles. And we're at the bar. So like things are looser and drinks are flowing and it's not like in the workplace, quote unquote. So people are like saying stuff that you wouldn't necessarily like say in a meeting. And mostly everybody was having fun. And these days it kind of feels like it's harder to do that. Mm-hmm. And that's bad. And I do think that that's true. 17% say much harder, 27% say somewhat harder, 33% say neither easier nor harder, 10% say somewhat easier, 4% say much easier.
And what's interesting is there's like not that much difference between men and women on this in the crosstabs. Like there's slightly more men will say harder, but it's not that big of a difference. So
I mean, which I think is relevant and telling that it's not just, you know, 25% of the male population are like hardcore predators and they're like mad that they've lost a permission structure, right? Like there's a fairly widespread sentiment among both men and women, particularly ones who are older and like were more exposed to older workplace norms, that there's some kind of like walking on eggshells kind of occurring.
And the age gradient is interesting here too. I don't know if you looked at that, but the people who say it's much harder, 21% of people 30 to 44 say that it's much harder. That's the highest number. And it's young people and old people who are like, nah, seems mostly fine.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that sort of makes sense if you think about different cohorts and how things go. So I'm like squarely in the much harder domain. And, you know, this is something that I thought about a lot at that time, because Me Too was also happening at a time when I had transitioned, I would say, from being like a young person in the workplace to like, I was one of the oldest people at Vox. And I was like a founder of the website. And like, you know, I wasn't anybody's boss, but I was clearly like a senior figure in the newsroom at that time, and not as I had been earlier. Like even in my directly prior job, I worked at Slate, and Slate just had a very different age profile of the staff. Yeah. So even though I was like a fairly prominent writer there, I wasn't an editor, hadn't been involved in founding it. Some people had been working there for a long, long, long time. A lot of them were way older than me. And I kind of thought of myself as like one of the kids. Then I come to Vox, I'm like, no, I'm not. I'm like, I'm not one of the kids anymore. And so that has different kinds of implications, right? And it's like, well, I should be like mentoring younger people and like helping them, right? And I should be being like nice to them and I should be being helpful to them. But suddenly I'm like a little like, what about this? Like what is and isn't appropriate? Like, do I need to like check myself? And then I was like out on the other side and I was like, no, wait, am I now in like the bad zone where like I would like, I'm being excessively reluctant to like take a young woman writer out to lunch, which like I think would be like a nice thing to do, right? And like I'm now like, I'm like overly worried about that being read the wrong way.
Yeah.
And so now this is going to like disadvantage. And it's like, I don't know. And then COVID happened. And
I feel like you're underrating yourself. Matt, you, I mean, I was, I was in, I joined Vox in 2020 and you were super normal and nice to all the young people there.
We were just on Zoom though, you know? No. But I mean, like it's relevant, you know, like you know, how are you interacting with people face to face and like socially and casually? Fortunately for me, in some ways, I also had like a young child at home at that point in time. So I was like doing very little socializing. But, you know, as I become like a middle-aged man and, you know, I go to conferences and I meet young people and so on and so forth, it's like you see that there's like a kind of like a triple reverberation of some of these kinds of problems. And like young men are much more sort of comfortable and like eager to kind of like put themselves forward to be like, hey, you should talk to me. You know what I mean? Because they, in part, maybe they just like me more, but you know, it's like, they don't like worry about their intentions and openness like being misread or putting them in like a bad position. But I'm also way more comfortable. It's like if I'm like hanging out with some guy who's 20 years younger than me, nobody's like, what's going on here? And, you know, again, like it would be helpful actually to just like have a rule book that's like, this is what we want people to do. This is good. This is bad, et cetera. Like there is something, there are bad HR trainings. Like, as you say, when you start to be like, don't be racist. And you're like, okay. And then you're like, and what does that mean? And you like go off into these like metaphysics of whiteness.
Yeah.
Like that's not helpful to people, but just something that's like, these are the rules of racism. And different people can have different opinions, but like, these are the rules. And if you follow the rules, you're okay. And if you break the rules, you're not okay. Like that's very helpful to people.
But I think this is, I mean, I understand. I think that I agree with you from like a, you know, an employer point of view. Like you should be very, very clear what rules are and what like, can be broken and what would be a fireable offense or like a, you know, actionable offense in the workplace, like all of that. But putting it aside, like, I just think like the fact that human beings relate to each other in ways that are complicated and sometimes difficult to categorize is like a fact of like being alive and interacting with other people. And like you actually like sometimes someone's creepy to you. And what's happening there is that like they actually are have some really nefarious intent. And sometimes it's very, very difficult to know, like, is this creepy thing happening? Is this like just I'm overly worried about this person? It just happens to be that it's really dark outside and they're like walking near me for no reason, whatever. Like there's lots of things that go into that that like create a gut feeling of something being wrong or right. Right. And I think that like for people who are concerned about being like misconstrued about their behavior and actions, like I definitely think it's like reasonable to have like norms of professionalism that I think have like actually been implemented not just because of sexual harassment but concerns, but because of like, you know, young person exploitation concerns, whether like interns or like whatever, that have like come out, or like the idea that, you know, should you be drinking, you know, taking shots with your colleagues until like 3 a.m. And one of them is a manager. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it's like these are things that like I think transcend just sexual harassment that became like an extra level of concern during the Me Too era. But like we're already percolating as like maybe this is like inappropriate to, like workplace interaction to be having. And again, like this is like super, I think this conversation has become like maybe like overly like media focused, which was like a, you know, an epicenter of this shift. But I mean, I worked in 2012. I was working like, I mean, I was in high school, but I spent 40 hours a week working on the Obama 2012 campaign. And, you know, when I was there, I had my first beer. I was like 16 years old. There was like beer in the fridge. Like, you know, the fellows, we all like drinking and like having fun and like going out. Like, I don't think that like any of the real adults were like explicitly like, here, we're giving you alcohol, but everyone's like super chill about it. And then like after college, I worked on campaigns again. And again, like it was a very
Obama
like
Obama doing crimes on his reelection campaign.
Exactly. Gave Jerusalem Dempsey her first beer. It was a Blue Moon in the Kensington office in Maryland, for anyone's wondering.
Okay.
Yeah. And so highbrow beer being given around out there. But so anyway, but like then I did politics after that and I was like, no, it did not feel any different. Like I was, you know, we were going out to bars, like people were drinking, et cetera. And this is like in, 2017, 2018, 2019 or whatever. And I think that there's a level to which media is like really over-indexing its own specific experience because everyone who you're socializing with in the context of your work has the ability to make anything you do public and it feels very newsworthy. Like Leon, who we were talking about earlier, is like, there are like, if you consider his role relative to like all media people, like we're talking about like an upper tier middle manager almost at like many, many companies. And like those people would never have articles written about
them. Yes, absolutely.
But I just think my point here is like, I don't actually think this vibe shift that we're talking about here has actually shifted like people's ability to like interact normally with one another in most workplaces across America, which is evidenced by this poll result, which is that like the majority of people say it's either easier or neither easier nor harder. And it's like, yeah, like,
right.
That seems relevant to me. You know, I just worry about us over-indexing on like specifically.
Well, I don't Vox, know. I mean, sure. But as you say, right, I mean, like this is just like one of my core qualms about Me Too. Again, not a question of going too far,
yeah,
but a question of being too like unclear. Is it because it was so dominated by journalism, right? Like as yeah. like as a mode of change, it was like about notoriety and publicity.
Yeah.
And so people were under scrutiny, not really in proportion to their objective significance in society. Because you say, right, like the guy who runs a Walmart obviously supervises dramatically more people than like yeah. an editor at a small circulation magazine. Fuckload of people work at a Walmart.
Yeah.
But those people are very obscure. And in particular, they're not interesting to other people who work in the media.
Yeah.
Right? So it was like we had this very kind of haphazard, you know, inquiry into what people have been up to and what people have been doing. We had a shift in vibes. I do think a shift in norms occurred.
I mean, I think the best evidence for that is the EEOC complaints. So I was looking at the number of complaints people give to the EEOC about sexual harassment. And in fiscal year 2023, it received its highest number in 12 years, up nearly 25% from the previous year. So like 2023, this is like we're in full backlash to Me Too mode at this point, right? And yet there's like this large increase of sexual harassment complaints has continued apace, which indicates to me that like this norm shift is like pretty durable, at least through now, that people are like, okay, there are things that are inappropriate in the workplace and there's someone I can call. Now, most people do not. Obviously, we're talking about like roughly like 7,700 charges of sexual harassment that are being filed. Like, it's a very small number relative to the number of people in the workforce. I'm sure there's many more instances of sexual harassment, but it just indicates to me something about like people sensing that there's something inappropriate going on and being willing to say something about it has gone up. And that is like, that's shifted.
Well, then this is my other question, which I think is hard to know the answer to, but it's like, is there less sexual harassment than there used to be? Like, did yeah. the norms change? You know, because even something like you said, right? So now everybody knows to tell pollsters that there is a lot of harassment that is not reported to the authorities, mm-hmm. Which like I think is true, right? So like that's a good reason to say it. But then like, so what, right? Does that idea getting out like lead to less harassment? Does it lead to people of bad motivations learning that this is actually easier to get away with mm-hmm. than 90s pop culture? Yeah, you know, because some of the like, not the Me Too backlash, but the earlier backlash, the backlash that Susan Faludi writes about, right? Some of that backlash was like, oh shit, we're like under this all-seeing scoldy panopticon.
Yeah.
And I'm mad about it. But like, that arguably is the desired effect, right? Is like for people to feel like their conduct is under an extreme level of scrutiny, so they'd better do the right thing. Versus if it's like, oh, now like the woke thing to say is like people are just getting away with this everywhere. And it's like, what does that, if belief that unreported harassment is widespread leads to a change, which leads to people not getting away with it, like that's good. But if it's just like now the conventional wisdom is like I can mistreat people and get away with it, that does not seem that constructive. And I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, like to be clear, like I just don't think you actually get to the like the end goal of like the feminist movement is that people view women as like individuals with like agency and then do not treat them as if they are sexual objects in professional work environments, as students, as whatever it is, and like allow them to be like full versions of themselves. Like Amiya Srinivasan wrote this really great book. She's a feminist scholar, and she wrote this book called The Right to Sex. And one of the essays in the book is about why it's actually wrong to sleep with your students as a professor.
Mm-hmm.
And like people have like kind of like, you know, the power dynamic conversation, like whatever it is. But like the thing that she gets at in that essay is that, you know, there is a passion for the subject that a student might exhibit or like have an interest in an intellectual journey. And women, when they are expressing that interest, can have that interest diverted by their professor into like, now we're having a romantic relationship. Mm-hmm. Whereas men will often have that diverted into like, we're having these long stimulating conversations about these issues. And so you are actually taking advantage of your role to like not push your student towards this like intellectual apotheosis, but like towards like your own sexual gratification. And like, I think to me, like what this essay and what many things like this get at is like, what you want is for people to think of women differently as like not just as like as being people who are you might interact with in like non-sexual ways, even if you find them attractive, in the same way that you might, interact with men in that role. And that is the goal. And like, I just, it's a really, really hard thing to do to get people to behave this way. And while I have my criticisms of these like leadership-less movements, like my criticism of that is largely downstream of the fact that like social media has made it really, really easy for someone to be an author, for someone to be like start up a protest, and like it doesn't require like the institutional force of like an NAACP or whatever it is in order to like generate that public visibility. And as a result, like people who are upset can just sort of be a movement without it actually indicating anything about a organizational structure that has the ability to affect change in policy.
So, okay, but like, I mean, this is nobody's fault because it's the nature of a leaderless movement.
Yeah.
But I think this Srinivasan essay, which came out quite a bit after sort of like peak Me Too, is interesting precisely because it is outlining a much more specific idea. And like an idea that's quite different from the power dynamic idea that is more commonly invoked, right? There was just a case where there was a story in the New York Post, and it said that Senator Ruben Gallego, when he was a young House member, had dated staffers in other House offices. I think it was Ana Paulina Luna, a Republican, but who doesn't like Gallego. She did a tweet and she was like, this is wrong because of the extreme power differential that exists. And it was funny because she's a conservative Republican and she's like invoking this like lib power dynamic kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And then most people just kind of like shrugged it off because there's no formal like authority that a House member has against staffers in other members' offices. And there isn't a rule against it or anything like it. And so it's like the world moves on, right? I think if you could re-rephrase the complaint in Srinivasan terms, it becomes a little bit clearer, like what you are trying to say there, which is essentially that members of Congress and congressional staffers in other offices are bound to interact in contexts that are not like boss reportee, but that are professional in nature, mm-hmm. right? Like you're talking to the legislative director in somebody else's office, even if you're at a happy hour, right? It's like a Democratic House happy hour. It's a work event, right? And so there's this idea that Srinivasan is like putting on the table that we want to like completely kind of like silo off, right, our professional interactions with people from sexual interactions with people, mm-hmm. because it is going to sort of disproportionately hamper the work of women. Whether it's like in a scholarly context, but like anything where it's like, you know, you have a passion for politics. That's why you're there. You're interested in talking to members because they are like, you know, like senior figures in the pantheon.
And it's like exciting. Like politics. You're like a young person. Right. You're like, oh, cool. You know,
exactly. And that like is actually like a different idea.
Yeah.
From the idea that has like been mainly put forward here. And I think like, you know, her book, you know, she did the podcast tour and the book was respectfully reviewed. And mm-hmm. if you're like a thinky person, you should be familiar with these ideas. But it's also like at a level of if people want to like scandalmonger about a House member, that it's not expressed in those terms.
Yeah.
Because it's not the like actual common social understanding of what the complaint is.
Me Too didn't go far enough. We need Srinivasan Me Too.
Well, maybe, right? But like it's a whole different process, right? Like it's a whole different, because that's actually talking, because part of Me Too was putting these power dynamics on a continuum with really coercive physical assault and rape, right? And part of what you're saying, and the Srinivasan concept is like to say no, that like that's actually not the issue here, right? Yeah. Like it's not fundamentally a question of coercion. And then you open like a whole set of other conversations that people are having about like dating apps, right? And like the shift of like, for a good span of time, it was very common for people to you know, meet their wives and husbands, like through the workplace or workplace related socializing. And now everything is like moved to apps and dating websites and things like that. And the technology has at least made it feasible to say, okay, it's like, if you want to find a date with somebody, you like go here, right? You like, you go to the dating website. Mm-hmm. And if you want to like, just like shoot the shit with people at a work adjacent happy hour, you go to the happy hour. And these are like completely distinct spheres of human life. I have aged out of this. I met my wife on Match.com, et cetera. Like, it's all fine by me. Like, let's have a separation. But a lot of people seem like actually very unhappy with the kind of like apps-based dating universe. And it would be good, I think, to like explicitly have that conversation, rather than the conversation about power.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a couple things here. One is like this question of like solidarity, right? Which is like, I think this is a difficult thing in all social movements, which is that like the thing you want to do, especially if you are in a minority, which women technically are not in a minority, but like if you're in a disadvantaged situation, is you want to like create as many people as possible who feel like they're invested in your movement personally, right? And this is like the invention of like Asian American as an identity, right? That like brings together someone who's Hmong with someone who's, you know, Chinese. I mean, it's just like a bunch of different people with a bunch of different technically cleaving differences. But like, we're going to have this big umbrella understanding, like, we are Asian American. There are harms that happen to our community that we have in common with one another. We're going to identify with those harms. Like, this is politics, right? Like, you need to do this in order to like have the interests of sometimes a very small minority of people actually respected. And so like, I remember during Me Too, right? Like, there were these articles that were really focused on the harassment that like restaurant servers faced, and that like, you know, in order to like get tips, you had to be really okay and friendly and often welcoming of interactions that were sexually inappropriate or that were really uncomfortable. And you couldn't really express that because your actual financial needs were on the line. I remember there was one article, I forget where it was, we can put it in the show notes, that like talked about how, you know, servers had to be okay with sexual harassment from their colleagues in order to make sure that, like, you know, if the cook is mad at you for being shitty about how he commented on your body, then maybe he will burn your food and you won't get tips, or he won't treat your lunch order as being as important to rush out the door, and then people will be mad about how long it took to get their food. And, you know, I think that like every person understands that there's like really bad cases of sexual abuse and rape. And there's also like really bad cases of sexual harassment when someone's in an extremely vulnerable economic position that like exceeds that of high powered professional working class white collar women in media or in, you know, in Hollywood or whatever. But like, tying together the fates of all these people in like a solidaristic movement is like how you get change. Like, you need the power of the women in Hollywood to be with the women who are servers at, you know, Wendy's or whatever it is. And like, that is a difficult process because often we see this time and again, right? When these kinds of processes happen, that solidarity is often used to attack sometimes the low-hanging fruit, which is stuff that doesn't actually benefit clearly the women who are the most harmed. But like, to me, I mean, obviously this is very hard to do, but like, you know, you would want to find out, like, is life better for young girls who are doing serving jobs? Like, it seems unclear to me. Like, in some ways, it seems like tip culture has shifted significantly. It seems like somewhat in relation to this, but like not largely in relation to this, mostly in relation to like COVID and like, you know, tipping your wait staff appropriately. And like, has that been the big shift there? So I think that like, a big part of the critique here is like, how do you manage a solidaristic movement where the interests are like so actually divergent in some cases because the class position of the people in question is like quite different? And I don't know. I mean, it's just a hard problem. And like, it's very, very difficult right now to imagine a feminist organization or any kind of like, you know, social movement organization being able to maintain a level of discipline over all the people who are interested in this movement and consider themselves a part of it in order to say, yeah, like, this is what we're fighting for. These are the rules. No, that doesn't count. Because like, anyone can get 10 million views on Twitter by saying like someone's a sexual harasser, and then they're viewed as part of this other thing that, like, you know,
well, that's why I just like, I want to know, because I mean, I agree, right? It's like, everybody's working with the world that exists and they can't do certain things. And I mean, I'm just curious. And I think it's been underexplored. Like, what has changed actually? Like, are things different? Are they better? Like, in what way? Like, what happened here? Because it seems to me like certain kinds of stories that would have run in 2018 just wouldn't run today, right? That like the Harvey Weinstein investigation happened originally because this is a super prominent person engaged in really egregious misconduct.
Yeah.
And then that came out. There was a lot of discussion about it. There was a lot of like follow-on stuff. There was Matt Lauer, you know? And so then like the bar starts getting lowered for like how noteworthy does something have to be to get published? And then other things happened. You know, and like the world moves on.
It's obviously very difficult to quantify this, not in a way that I would love. I think that like it is really clear to me that like a lot of, I mean, like if you want to look just specifically in Hollywood, I mean, like the rise of intimacy coordinators is literally a function of like people worrying that these like sexual scenes are not being treated in like a professional context. They're making people uncomfortable. Right. Like that's like, that was like not a thing pre Me Too. And now it's like very much a thing like everywhere and mandated in many studios.
But like, is a waitress less likely to be sexually harassed?
I don't know.
By the cook?
And I have no idea.
No, me neither.
Yeah. Yeah.
It seems like a thing that has been so discussed has been very little measured.
But I actually think this is like a measurement problem rather than an interest problem. Like, I just think it's like how you would measure this through reporting, but reporting is obviously variable, particularly in these categories where there's a lot of gray area. And so like, are people reporting different things now than they were before? And so like, actually there's increased reporting is a result of people being willing to understand that they're, you know, reporting something that was already happening earlier. Like, I think it's actually like almost unknowable to know like when was peak sexual harassment happening. Like, it's just like not something you can understand. But I just like, as like an observer of culture, when I watch like rom-coms or things like that now, like the shifting script, I think, is incredibly evident in culture. Like, it was a really normal trope in many, many kind of romantic comedies to imagine, like, you know, you get drunk and you go home with you know, with someone, and then you guys end up having sex in the morning. You're like, oh shit, what did I do? Right? Like, the most popular, I think, I mean, I don't have the stats in front of me, but an extremely popular romantic TV show that has just come out on Amazon Prime, which is called Off Campus. It's like the straight heated rivalry, the straight hockey TV show, for anyone who hasn't listened to this. I mean, there's like a literal scene where like the main love interest is drunk and the guy who is like the heartthrob of the movie, like, doesn't have sex with her. And it's not like a cringe, like whatever. It's just like, oh, of course, like he's not gonna have sex with her right now. And like, it just, everyone just kind of moves on. And I'm just like, these are things that are very difficult to quantify, but I just do think like social scripts have shifted in a way that have made people like more aware of what types of behavior are like good or what it means to be like a good person. Like, that movie, that TV show does not say never have sex if you've had a drink, but it like indicates to you that you should be like thoughtful about like when you are choosing to engage in like the first time sexual encounter with someone and like whether it's appropriate to do that when they seem impaired.
Time for some peer review?
Yeah, now you guys all have to go watch this show.
That's right. Yeah, we got to stop. Listen to the peer review segment and then go watch this show.
Well, no, they haven't sponsored us yet, so maybe don't go watch the show.
Okay, don't.
Yeah. Amazon Prime, we're waiting.
All right, we'll take a break and then come to something that we can quantify.
So this is our peer review section where we talk about a recent working paper or white paper. Today's is Dynamic Individuals, Static Neighborhoods, Migration and Earnings Changes in Poor Neighborhoods. Not a very fun title, but it is a very descriptive title. These are by some economists, Andrew Guerin, Evan Mast, Ethan Jenkins, and Brian Stewart. They're at various different universities. So there's like this like problem that this paper is trying to engage in, which is sort of this like, why is it that some poor neighborhoods stay poor? Like, there are some places in town, like anywhere you live, where you're like, this place has been poor forever. Like, what's going on here, right? And there's like this, often this view where it's just like, oh, well, it's almost like, it's like endemic to this population of people. And what this paper does is finds that actually the migration rates, like people leaving these neighborhoods, is actually incredibly high. Like, people leave poorer neighborhoods all the time at higher rates than other people are moving out of other neighborhoods. And it is when they're able to make more money that people immediately leave, which creates this like really difficult cycle, right? Where like if the people who are now making money don't like stay and continue to like pay rent and go to the local shops or whatever, that place is actually suffering from like constant drain of its most productive individuals that make it difficult for those neighborhoods to ever kind of rise up out of it. But it's like should shift people's, I think, conventional understandings of like that's like the poor part of town where poor people live to like, yeah, like anyone who's lived there for some small period of time just kind of gets the out of Dodge the second they're able to get a job. They're able to afford housing opportunities and better neighborhoods. And I really, there's so much to talk about this paper, but I don't know, Matt, if you have kind of your reactions.
Right. So, I mean, I just need to kind of like set the groundwork here, right? Because America has a political system in which elected officials represent specific geographies. So if the geography that you represent contains a lot of like troubled people or just people who are poor, right? There's this natural impulse to say, I want like a place-based solution. I want this universe of low-income South Bronx neighborhoods that I represent to like not be like that anymore.
Yeah.
But there's only two ways that that can happen. The individual people who live there can get more money, or different people who don't live there and have money can move there.
Yeah.
Right? Like, just logically, those are the two possibilities. And the problem that we see is that when a place becomes less poor due to more affluent newcomers arriving there, that's usually not considered like a success story, right? That's gentrification. And it's bad, or it's bad, quote unquote. Certainly, it's not necessarily helping the poor people who were living there originally.
Allegedly.
When the people who were living there get more money, that definitely helps them. But the first thing that poor people do when they become less poor is they're like, you know what? Like, I don't need to keep living in this shitty neighborhood.
Yeah.
And they leave. So there's this kind of like impossible dream of like the rising tide lifting all boats, in which the community stays stable and intact, but the individuals who live in the community become more prosperous. And then some of the dysfunctions associated with a neighborhood being full of poor people like go away. There's like nicer stores and, you know, all the lawns are kept up better, et cetera. And it doesn't seem like you can actually do that. In a minority of cases, you can gentrify.
Yeah.
And in a larger number of cases, you can have exit. But like, you can, in a society of individuals, you like can't make there be a rule that's like, you get a better job, but you're not allowed to take your higher paycheck for your better job to go personally move to a better neighborhood.
You actually can do this, Matt. This is what happened during, I mean, I wrote this piece at The Atlantic a few years back about, about the declining number of Black or the Black share of the population in many cities kind of going down. Mm-hmm. And people often lament this, right? And they talk about this. And when you, similarly to this paper, what you see is that often what's occurring is that for a long time, racial discrimination meant that like the fate of middle class Black people was like tied to the fate of like lower class Black people because they were like literally racially segregated into a specific area of town. And then as racial discrimination started to decline and like formal levers of segregation were removed, like DC is a great example of this. Like a lot of middle class Black people moved from neighborhoods in DC across the river towards the suburbs. And like you see suburbanization of the middle class Black community across the United States happening all the time. And like in this paper, they find that 78% of people who are exiting high poverty neighborhoods are relocating to areas below the high poverty threshold, including many tracts that have much lower poverty rates, right? So like, these are not people who are just like going and transient and moving to like similarly shitty neighborhoods. They're moving to like better areas. And like this actually like raises, I mean, they reference William Julius Wilson's The Truly Disadvantaged in this paper. And it's just like, it raises like a really difficult problem here, which is that like, yes, like, it is literally better for the very, very poor, for the truly disadvantaged, when middle class people are forced to live next to them and remain part of their community. But that's obviously like in contrast with our like views around individuals having rights to like make their lives better. I mean, to me, the you can solve this very easily by like eliminating most zoning regulations and providing vouchers to poor people to be able to live wherever. And so that affordable housing gets mixed in with all other neighborhoods and there's not this kind of like segregation happening anywhere else. But I do think that like in this current society, like if you're going to have this kind of segregation and then you're going to say like, why is it that this area of town is persistently high poverty? Like, yeah, like you constructed it this way. Like you've done this, you know?
Well, right. But I mean, I think just like more credit to people, you know, just like people coping with these kinds of things. If you are a House member who represents like a low income district someplace, like it's hard.
You should be pro gentrification.
Sure. Yes. So there's the gentrification solution. Yeah. But I mean, the Jerusalem solution that's like people are just going to leave my district and go elsewhere. Like that's probably like you would be morally wrong to try to prevent that from happening. But like the nature of representative government in a democracy is that like you have to like fight for your district.
Well, I don't know, like community. Many people obviously don't want to leave. Right? I think there are lots of people who would prefer their neighborhood to get better such they didn't have to move. Like some people like had bad experiences. They want to leave, whatever. Right. Like that's fine. That happens all the time. But lots of people make more money and remain in their communities because they like their communities. Like it is possible to, again, through gentrification often or through whatever we can call it something else, through public and private investment, increasing the amenities of a community and therefore attracting higher income individuals and college educated individuals. By doing that, you can make it possible that like everyone wants to both stay and new people want to move there. Like that's actually like the solution to this problem. The issue is that, as you know, I'm preaching to the choir here or whatever, but like the issue is that people don't just want, oh, I want to help the people in my community make more money and like have more material well-being. It's they literally don't want anything to change. They're like mad when the corner store like is no longer the same corner store. They're mad when like the the park nearby now is being used for soccer as well as basketball. And it's just like you're like both want everything to change about the material circumstances of the community and also like nothing to change visibly, culturally, institutionally. And like that to me is what's like why I don't have very much sympathy for people here, because like there is a solution if you are in, to be clear, when we're talking about I think often what we're talking about here are like high poverty neighborhoods in urban areas. I think it's a very different problem for high poverty areas in rural places.
Well, so I mean, yes, I definitely think like one takeaway from this is that you should have a more positive view of gentrification as a process, right? That in terms of possible things that can happen to a neighborhood that's full of poor people, having non-poor people move into it is better for almost everyone involved than a scenario where the least poor people in the poor neighborhood all just exit.
Yeah.
Right? Which is not to say that we should stop people from leaving. It's just that that's a problematic dynamic.
Yeah.
Whereas more affluent people come in, you know, it's fine. But then, yeah, as you say, it's like so much of our politics, I feel like, is dominated right now by, on the one hand, people say they want like big changes to the economic structure of American society. But on the other hand, they're like very resistant to anything being different.
Yeah.
And you just like, you can't do that. Like if things were different.
They would be different.
Things would look, I mean, not just they would be different, but things would look different.
Yeah.
Right. That if you go, I mean, this is very dramatic, but if you go, like you look at like Shenzhen going from a obscure fishing village to like a center of global tech production, it looks completely different.
Yeah.
Right. Like it's not like, oh, it's secretly different. It's quite obviously different.
Yeah.
And the same thing is true. I mean, if you look at a high poverty neighborhood in the United States, if that were to become a thriving middle class neighborhood, it would look different.
Yes.
There would be a different ethnic balance of people who are there. There would be different stores there.
Yeah.
There would be different physical structures there. And if you want it to be the same, like, fine. But then nothing's going to change if everything is the same.
I will say too, we have a homeownership episode that we've taped, and this paper yet again is another check in the anti-homeownership take bucket for Jerusalem. They find in this paper that renters have it's much easier for them to take advantage of, you know, increased amounts of money that they're making to leave poor neighborhoods. So, like, if you're a homeowner, you're kind of like, it's harder for you to leave. So, like, one strategy, if you want to keep people really locked in place, is to help them buy homes in shitty neighborhoods, which is, I think, actually the policy of the U.S. federal government right now. So they are doing that.
There you go.
Great. I don't know. I thought it was a great paper. I really enjoyed it. I mean, obviously, it's kind of our jam. I did think you need to do a Jane. I forgot about this. Matt needs to do a Jane Jacobs apology, mea culpa here. So in the paper, they talk about the death and life of great American cities, which Matt and I recently read for a podcast. Is Jane Jacobs' great book. Matt had, you know, a real scorching hot disagreement with Jacobs about her failure to think about economics. And in this paper, they validate the Jacobian thesis about how slum formation happens. She writes, once a slum has formed, the pattern of immigration that made it is apt to continue. Successful people, including those who achieve very modest gains indeed, keep moving out. They are quickly replaced by others who currently have little economic choice. She did econ. Are you happy?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, whatever. I don't want to get back into Jane Jacobs. You know, I think like part of the relevance of this, though, is to like ethnic enclave neighborhoods as well, which is a kind of thing where, you know, like a lot of people, this came up like, you know, Mamdani his administration put out some like map of like New York's immigrant neighborhoods. And because of Mamdani derangement syndrome, he got like a lot of shit from people for not having Little Italy be on the map. And of course, anybody who knows New York knows that it's been a long time since Little Italy was an Italian ethnic neighborhood. But when I was a kid, it was like quite common to lament the fact that Little Italy wasn't really there anymore.
Yeah.
Because Little Italy was like a fun place to visit. And it was semi-existent in the early 90s, but clearly on its way out. And it's like the same thing. It's like in DC, we have like a Chinatown, but it's completely fake. And it would be way more entertaining for like non-Chinese residents of Washington, DC to have a proper Chinatown to go to. But like, again, the only way to preserve a neighborhood like that is with some kind of like hard exclusion.
Yeah.
Like as people make more money or develop language skills or whatever it is that's like keeping them stuck, like they're gonna go.
We could have targeted immigration programs to bring Italians and Chinese people to specific areas in town. They have to remain in those communities. I think that could be a nice win-win
situation. We could have the huku system for it. No, but I mean, it's also, you know, it also becomes like a development thing.
No, we do place-based visas for... for Chinese immigrants.
I mean, they're probably, because there's so many people in China, like you could do this, but it's like, Italy's not poor enough, right?
I think you could get enough Italians to make Little Italy happen again. I believe in Mamdani.
Okay, that would be fun.
Well, we've come out in favor of a huku system, so I think it's time to close out the pod. join us again next week, guys, for our next podcast. We are reading Robert Putnam's Bowling Alone for our next book episode. So,
a book by a man.
A book by...
Shameful.
Finally. They've been underrepresented for so long. But thanks, everyone. See you next week.